everyone, and welcome to episode 132 of season 11 of Movie Our Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is John from the Armchair Commanders podcast. Welcome to the show, John.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really glad that we were able to get in touch with one another and was able to get you on some episodes here. So I'm very excited for us to discuss these three segments over the next 3 days of Band of Brothers.
It's always a good time talking about Band of Brothers.
Yeah, sure. So why don't you first tell me and everyone else your background with Band of Brothers?
So, like you said, I'm the host of a war movie review podcast, and I've been fortunate enough. So I have my degree in history. That's how I kind of got started on all that. I think like a lot of people with Band of Brothers was probably one of the first nonfiction books I ever read. And, as a kid, I loved reading Stephen E. Ambrose's works. Having gotten a little older and more into it, you kind of realize that, there's some issues with the stuff that he's written, but it's still such a great jumping off point for history and getting into that subject. And it's a terrific cross section between history as well as, pop culture and media. But through doing the podcast, we've been fortunate enough that we've had a few of the actors from Band of Brothers actually come on our show and discuss some of their favorite war films with us.
Oh, wow.
We've also had a couple of family members of Easy Company veterans join us as well and talk about, their parents or grandparents, or whatever. So it's, even though I myself don't have a direct relation to it, it's one of those things that, much like the rest of the history community, getting involved in the story of Easy Company is a very open, like, people are usually very open to including you and chatting with you about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I found that too, that all the people that I've spoken to that are connected to Band of Brothers, they were all really, really happy to talk about it. And again, it's 25 years. So, it's not something that you normally find, that, the people that acted or that were part of some movie or TV production that, 2.5 decades later, they're still very enthusiastic to talk about it. And then it's fresh in their mind, and it's something that they're still very proud to talk about, stuff like that. So it's been great. I've really enjoyed all of my interviews that I've done, with people part of the cast and the crew, stuff like that. It's been great. And obviously the real family members of the men from from Easy Company. Excellent. All right. So how many times do you think you've seen this miniseries? Do you have any guess?
That is a hard one to put a number on, because it's kind of like, I like to equate, this might sound weird, but I like to equate Band of Brothers to the Shawshank Redemption, in the fact that, so Shawshank Redemption is a film that the licensing for it is super easy to get. Not that Band of Brothers is, but the licensing for Shawshank Redemption is really easy to get. So it plays on TV all the time. And Shawshank Redemption is one of those films that if it's on TV, and it doesn't even matter where in the movie it is,
like, you'll pick it up where it is, right? Okay.
Yeah, I'll just stop and start watching it. So like, I couldn't tell you how many times I've seen that film. And I think Band of Brothers is very much the same, because it's one of those, with the advent of streaming and all that, we aren't really stuck with whatever is just on TV now.
Correct.
But I would say, like, I always watch it the entire series straight through every year, every June, to coincide with, D-Day anniversary and all that, because I think that's a good time to watch it. But it's also one of those things where it's like that Band of Brothers in the Pacific, like, if I'm cleaning the house, I'll just put it on in the background as kind of like background noise,
Okay.
So I don't have an exact number, but I would have to say it has to be like triple digits at this point.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, and I can't say I've
Now,
seen
how
the
much
other
of that is
versions.
like actually like I'm paying attention to every single second? No, but it's been quite a few watch throughs.
Okay. Have you ever broken it down the way that we're doing it here?
No, it's a very interesting concept that you got going, doing it 5 minutes at a time. It also, it's, especially with, the 5 minute section we're starting with, depending on where you cut it's like, it can be like, okay, we're starting off like really hardcore for a second, and then it like tapers down, or you can be in the middle of just like a really weird moment, and you're like, out of context, this is kind of funky.
Exactly. Well, I mean, again, that's that. I mean, the obviously, I didn't make up the idea of doing it this way, and most of my seasons I've done 1 minute at a time, but because it would take me 2.5 years to do this, if I did this 1 minute at a time, I decided it would be easier to do it 5 minutes at a time and get it done in 6 months, from that perspective. So yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, next season, which will be starting next week, I'm going to be going back to the 1 minute format. So, it's not really my choice the way that I'm cutting it. I cut it based on where it all falls out. And I mean, obviously, you also got a little short change because our third episode, the one that we're going to do on Thursday, you don't even get 5 minutes. You get a little less than that. But that's the way it is. The way it works out, and you only get a 3 minutes instead of 5 minutes, but nothing you can do about that. Yeah. Well, again, I'm a purist. I prefer the ones that are closer to 1 minute anyway. But like I said, because of the amount of minutes in Band of Brothers, it just wasn't worth doing it 1 minute at a time each time. So. Exactly. So, episode 132 begins with the prisoner talking back and ends with Winters having news for Lip. So we ended things yesterday with the guys finally capturing this drunk GI who shot Grant, and they're just beating the crap out of him. Nobody really cares. And Spears has also joined in the fracas with them. And I mean, one of the things that we talked about the other day is that, I mean, they don't mention it here, but this guy was actually captured because he was trying to rape a local girl, after he had killed Grant and the other people. So, I mean, this is a guy who did a lot of damage. Let's put it that way. And a lot of the guys were not happy that he actually was still alive when they brought him in, as opposed to having gotten rid of him. Not much you can do about that from that perspective. And I mean, this is also a guy who was a replacement, and he was in Company I and things like that. So basically, yesterday we ended things with Spears asking him where's the weapon? And he responds, what weapon? And he has a little bit of a smirk on his face. And Spears doesn't really give a crap and just belts the guy, with a really, really hard backhanded slap while he's still holding his pistol in his hand. So that's gonna hurt. And we even get to see the blood shoot out of his mouth from this whole thing. And they do a great job because we get to see the reaction of some of the other men to what's going on here. And I mean, we see, for instance, Bull. And Bull is not fazed really about this whole thing. These guys, they're not like happy that this is going on, but they're also not sad. You know, they're very glad. They're trying to bring this man to justice, you know, for what he did to Grant. And Spears just looks at him and goes, "When you talk to an officer, you say sir." And you even have like it even looks like Babe is about to like burst out laughing in this scene. You know, I'm not sure if the actor was just trying to keep a straight face there, or if the idea is it's just so absurd what's going on that, you know, sometimes you're in a very absurd situation and it might be easier just to laugh instead of cry with what's going on. And again, Spears just he realizes this guy's not going to respond at this point. And then he cocks the gun and points it right at this guy's head, getting ready to execute him. And all of the men just back up, you know, and I think they're just backing up because they don't want to get blood on their clothes. Not because they think that what he's doing is not right. And, you know, at a certain point, he just decides that it's not worth it. He's not going to kill this guy. He just wipes the blood that's on his hand on the guy's uniform. And then he turns to the guys around him and he goes, "Have the MPs take care of this piece of shit." It's a great scene because mostly because of the fact that lets us see the reaction of all these men to what's going on. Now, here, a brother of theirs has been shot in the head. Nobody knows at this point what's happened to Grant. You know, is he alive? Is he dead? Anything? They just know that this guy is responsible. He's the one who shot him. And, you know, I don't think they would have been very indifferent if Spears had shot the guy. But you got to give Spears a lot of credit for the fact that, you know, he was able to hold on to himself and not execute this guy, even though he deserved it. I mean, one of the things that I find really interesting is I did a little bit of research about this particular guy that you know, that shot Grant. And I know I can tell you know, who he was basically. So the man who shot Grant was named Private Floyd Craver of I Company, and he had done a lot of drinking that day, was smoking marijuana, and they actually caught him a few hours later, relatively close to the hospital where they eventually took Grant to go do the surgery. And he was attempting to rape an Austrian girl at the time when he was caught. They found him guilty of shooting Grant, as well as desertion and the shooting of both the German and British soldiers. And he was sentenced to a dishonorable discharge and life in prison on March 6th, 1946, which is amazing that it took almost a year, you know, to convict this guy on what he clearly did. But the information is very scarce, but they don't understand why, but he was somehow released from prison not long afterwards. And he eventually died on July 6th, 1987, when he was hit by a truck, which
Oh
again
no.
isn't karma a bitch.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should all
Yeah,
cry
that
for
is interesting because, you know, you think, you know, especially like middle of war, World War II, like justice is pretty swift. So a year for something like that, like, does kind of strike as odd.
Yeah, definitely does. But okay. That's the way it is. Maybe this guy was he became part of the next version of the Dirty Dozen, you know, where they would give him amnesty if he did something. I don't know. No way of knowing from that perspective. At this point, Spears starts just walking away and Talbert stops him and goes, "Grant's dead." And Spears goes, "Nope." He goes, "The crowd surgeon says he's gonna make it." So, you know, it's a good thing that Spears yesterday was able to get that German surgeon to take him Grant, because apparently it did save his life. And you know, it's very interesting. I mean, the book does talk about it, you know, about what happened to Grant after that. I mean, there's a scene in the book beforehand which mentions that you know, Sink had a conversation with Spears about this whole thing, and it basically it's on page 237 of the book. Says they beat him unconscious. They carried him into the regimental guardhouse and turned him over to the provost sergeant. When he revived, the provost sergeant beat him until the blood ran. Fink came to company HQ. He strode in and asked Sergeant Carson where Spears. Up on the second floor, sir. Fink went up and got his facts from Spears. It took the better part of an hour. Fink left and Spear came down. Had to go, Carson asked. Pretty rough. But what'd he say? He said I should have shot the son of a bitch. That he did not is remarkable. One explanation I got from a number of men was that Spears must have had some doubt that the arrested man was the right man. When I asked Spears about this, he replied, "As to the Sergeant Grant shooting, you have it right. There must have been doubt in my mind because summary action never troubled me. But I wonder if there was not another factor at work. Spears was not the only man who had a chance to shoot the coward. Grant had an opportunity in the initial encounter. The man who found the I Company drunk could have shot him on the spot. And nearly every man in the company interviewed by me said he wished it had been done. But many of them were at Company HQ when he was brought in wearing pistols. But only one of them actually tried to kill the man, and he was being held back by four others. Almost every man in the room had killed. Their blood was up. Their anger was deep and cold. But what stands out as the incident is not the pistol whipping and beatings, but the restraint. They had had enough of killing. So, it's pretty interesting that, they don't even give us a line or something explaining this part in the in the book, because I think it would have helped give us a little bit of more insight into why these guys didn't do it. Because when we look at them, we can't figure it out. When we're watching this, you don't know why Spears doesn't shoot him. So I think that they could have had like a small little scene where it would have said something to that effect. But what do you think?
I think it's a really great scene because one, it is very powerful, and the seriousness that Spears takes on in that scene definitely, like, it's already heavy and there's a lot of gravity to it, and Spears showing up just enhances that. Because I think the other part that lends to how powerful that scene is through the entire series, the men of Easy Company have, and the men of the regiment have kind of built up this legend or mythos around Spears. And you see it a little more during the Bastogne episode, but going all the way back to D-Day, because there's the scene where,
With a kid from Oregon, right?
and in the scene, it's alleged, we don't actually see him do it, it's just, very heavily implied that
Yes, very
Spears
heavily implied.
kills, this group of German prisoners. And that follows him, and he does it, he never throughout the series says, no, I didn't do this, or squashes it. He uses it as kind of a, almost like a leadership tool, where he's like, I inspire, compliance through this, like, level of fear almost. And it's one of those things that when you start digging into all of these guys' stories, I think that's one of the other great things about this series, is that, obviously this series is based off of one book. It's based off of Stephen E. Ambrose's work. But because of the series, after it got released, and after all of its popularity, you start seeing all of these different individual members of Easy Company start getting their own books and stories. Mularkey gets his own book, Spears has his own book now, Winters gets his own book. So it's great from the standpoint that at the time that this is released, like, we actually don't know a ton about Spears. It's just whatever Ambrose gave us, or whatever this series produced. And then, like, now, being 25 some years removed from the series release, and now we have all this scholarship around this one particular unit, it kind of takes away that mythos a little bit. But this, I think that's the thing that makes the scene really great, is that at this moment, the members of Easy Company, when Spears shows up, they just know him as, like, he is like the alpha of one of the alpha members of the regiment, and they just know, like, they believe he waxed like 20 Germans on D-Day by himself and all these things. So like when he walks in through the door after they've just beat the crap out of this dude for however long, they're like, oh, this is finally going to come to an end. And when it doesn't, like, that's such a, a jarring moment.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, in part seven, there's that conversation that Spheres has with Lipton, where he basically Lipton sort of asks him if he did shoot the men on D-Day, and his response is, what's more effective, knowing that a commander did it or thinking that possibly he did it. So I like the way that they did that in that part to give us a little bit of doubt of whether he did it or not, but also, you want to, as you said, you want to build the mythos around him that this is no nonsense guy who is going to do whatever's necessary out of patriotism and also to help his men. I mean, he became I guess the stepfather of Easy Company, once he stepped into the role of being Easy's commander after he took over for Dyke, that type of thing. Just like Winters is the father of Easy Company because he was constantly looking out for everybody. So, Spears was looking out for them in a different way than Winters has been doing it the whole time. So, yeah, I like the way that they show this.
I also find it interesting because you brought up the passage from the book about, saying that, Spears never had any issue about, doing
Restraint.
what was, yeah, no issue with restraint. And oh God, this was, I think I saw it maybe a year ago. It was either a YouTube documentary or it was an interview. Essentially, what the video was talking about was there was apparently a conversation that happened between Winters and Spears decades later, so post book release, and it's leading up to the filming of the series and it getting the attention that it's getting. And I think that's another interesting take is, when you're in the middle of a war where you're already seeing all of these different atrocities occurring and you have a job to do yourself, and it's one of those like taking the moral argument to the side for a moment. You're just, say you're the person like Spears who's like, there's a tough job to do and I'm going to be the one that does it. Like, I think those decisions in a high stress environment are a lot easier to just go with, because in the moment you're like, I have to do what is necessary now. But this video essay documentary thing that I watched was talking about leading up to the filming of this series, Spears had a conversation with Winters. So, they're in their 70s, 80s at this point. And it is at this point that Spears is like looking back and he's like, oh, some of the things I did during the war is kind of problematic. And he's talking to Winters because he's like, do you think this is going to cause us problems? Like, because again, it's the in wartime, it's, I don't want to compare it to the Nuremberg defense, but in a time of war, you have tough decisions to make, and it's easy to justify being like, you weren't in my position. However, doing that 60 plus years of hindsight of like, the feelings have cooled significantly towards our former enemies by that point.
Right.
It does raise that question. Plus, after that much time, that's a significant amount of time for you to sit with and think about the actions of your youth.
Right. Sure. No, I definitely agree with you on that. But again, this is something I've spoken to a number of people who even knew Spears, and they basically all said, we'll never know what really happened. It's not information. Everyone has their opinions about it. The only person who really knows the truth was Spears. And again, he wasn't talking because of obviously my assumption is for various reasons. One is because he liked the fact that there was this mythos around him, but also, as you said, maybe he thought some of the things might have been problematic. So, no reason to confirm that you did something wrong.
Right.
That type of thing. All right. Okay. So, I mean, the Spears then just walks away, and we see the men are somewhat relieved, but they're also not sure how to do it. And Liebgott then picks up this I guess you call him a prisoner. He goes, "Hey, tough guy, on your feet! Come on, move, move! Come on, get up!" And they take him out of there. And then the scene changes, and we see that Moore is defending himself, and he says, "I'm guessing they were Hitler's photo albums, sir." And he goes, "Sure, had a lot of pictures of him in it. So you looked at them, but you didn't take them." And he goes, "That's right, sir. I don't believe you." And Moore at that, just remains quiet. He doesn't answer anything, and Talbert shows up, and then Spear says to him, "You better not be lying to me. I'll be watching you. You're dismissed." And Moore then leaves, and as Moore's leaving, he sort of looks towards the camera and gives a little bit of a smirk, because I mean, we saw when they were when they did get to the Eagle's Nest, we saw that Moore was the one who was looking through the album, and there's no question about it that he did take it. What eventually happened to it, I couldn't really tell you, but it is something.
I love that too, because it was Spears that was questioning him again, right, in that scene.
And
And that's the other
Spears
thing,
is
is
a bigger
that through
loser.
this entire series, it's very well established that Spears is also a trophy souvenir hunter. Like, there's a scene where we see him shipping back an entire silver tea
That thing.
set back home, and
Well, he wasn't sending it home. He was just sending it to he was sending it to England, to whatever, to a woman who was basically duping him. But that's a separate issue.
yeah, but yeah, so like that's the other part of it too, is that like part of it you're like, yeah, the army would want this because air quotes intelligence, but 100% that Spears is just pissed off because he
He
didn't
didn't
get
get
it.
him. That's right. I think that's what it comes down to. I mean, the book also does talk about this. So it's on page 222. It talks about when they got to the Eagle's Nest. It says the Eagle's Nest had been thoroughly worked over by the Army Air Force. The elevator to it had been put out of action, but to men who had been up and down Kurri innumerable times, the climb to the top was more of a stroll than a challenge. Alton Moore was one of the first to get there. In the rubble, he found two of Hitler's photo albums, filled with pictures of the famous politicians of Europe who had been Hitler's guests. An officer from the company demanded that Moore turn over the albums to him. Moore refused. The officer threatened to court-martial him. Moore was in Malarkey's platoon. Malarkey ran to Battalion HQ to see Winters. He explained the situation. Winters told his jeep driver to take Malarkey back to his quarters and return with Private Moore and all his gear. When Moore arrived, Winter made him a driver for Battalion HQ. Thus was Moore able to take the albums home with him to Casper, Wyoming. So,
It's all about who you know.
that's right. And according to the book, again, the information is never 100%, not in the book, not in the series, and also not from the information you're going to get from all the men. But the bottom line is that according to the book, it wasn't Spears, but it is a great idea to put Spears in that position, based especially on what you just said. I mean, he himself was a major looter, so it would be very interesting that, he
Well,
just took, he didn't find it.
and that's the thing, is that, looting, trophy taking, souvenir hunting, that has been a part of warfare since the dawn of time, and it will continue in forever, basically. I think one of my favorite stories that I've heard, it's from another podcast that I listen to. It's called Smoke Pit. And basically it's supposed to be stories from service members about their time in the service. Hence smoke pit, because that's where people would meet to smoke and kind of bull with each other, kind of like water cooler talk. And there was an episode of this podcast that I listened to that had a guy who was in the Marine Corps during the 03 invasion of Iraq. And his unit was there when the very famous video of the citizens of Baghdad throwing ropes onto this statue of Saddam and tearing it down. So they topple this statue of Saddam. Well, it's a giant statue of Saddam. Once you've knocked it off its pedestal, you can't really move it. It's not going to go anywhere. And so this guy was, his story was, he was a part of some, I believe it was like an armored unit or something to that effect. So they had these big, heavy vehicles, and they also had the tools that go along with having a unit with big, heavy vehicles. So they had like torches and, saws and all this heavy stuff. And so him and his closest group of friends decided that their souvenir from the Iraq War was they were going to chop the hand off of the Saddam statue and bring it home. Now, mind you, the Saddam statue is massive. The hand probably would fit in the room I'm in currently. Like, it's like they only would be able to accomplish this solely because they're driving a vehicle that has that kind of space and lifting capacity to carry, however, like 1,000 pounds, bronze statue hand. And the part of this that gets interesting is because, everybody does this. They hide this hand in their vehicle and they like throw a tarp over it. And they're able to keep it for a couple of weeks. They'd never really. Step one was like, obviously, we're going to get the hand. But step two of how do we get this home was not really ever. That's the harder part of the equation. And so, really, what the point of the podcast is at some point, an officer does find out that they have the hand from the Saddam statue. And he said, and this officer says, "No, you are not keeping that." And basically he said, like, he uses executive decision. He's like, "You don't get that anymore. That is going to get loaded onto an airplane like immediately, and it's going to get flown out to the United States Marine Corps Museum." Which, that's out of all the potential options of what could have happened to that thing, is probably the best, other than like this guy being able to keep it and having it in his garage for however many years. But it becomes this big whodunit mystery because once they get it to the airplane, somewhere between Iraq and America, the hand disappears and nobody knows what happened or where it's gone since.
Okay, so I just did a little bit of a quick research on it. The statue itself was 39 feet tall, okay, and it weighed approximately 2 tons. So, just that hand is going to be pretty heavy.
Yeah, like I said, they had to like take torches to it to cut it off.
Oh well, so it's probably. And I wonder if that was a nonstop flight or if it stopped somewhere along the way. Because if it was a nonstop flight, that means it's probably somewhere in the ocean. But
But
who
yeah,
knows?
that's it. It's just a more recent example of the exact same thing. So the
Yeah,
fact that
for
this
sure.
dude found these albums and actually got away with bringing them home, like, kudos to you, dude. Like,
That's right. And then the conversation continues with Talbert, and Talbert says, "Sir, if it's not going to put you in too much of a bind, I'd like to resign as company first sergeant. If I had my choice, I miss being back amongst the men. I'd be happy to go to staff sergeant, whichever platoon you want to put me in. Bears looks at him and goes, well, I guess you've earned your right to demote yourself. Thank you, sir. He goes, you want to take over Sergeant Grant's platoon? And he goes, that would do fine, sir. All right, then report to Lieutenant Peacock. Let me know if he gives you any trouble. And he smirks a little bit when he says it, and he goes, oh, sir, make your decision yet? And he goes, yep, I did. And then the door closes. So again, this is I like the way they're like wrapping up everyone's story, basically type of thing here, by showing us the way that each of these men is now dealing with the fact that the fighting part of the war is over, and now it's a question of okay, what am I going to do next? That type of thing. And I like the way also they keep us a little bit of in suspense. For even if it's just for a few seconds as to what Beers has decided he's going to do. Because that's that'll be in the very next scene where we're going to talk about that. But it's also I guess you could say it's sort of convenient that Grant's position has now opened up, that type of thing. It's I'm not sure if in real life it probably went this smoothly, that like the day after Grant was shot, the Albert asked to move, and he said he gave him, and then he says give him his job. So, yeah, I don't know how long it. My assumption of based on the way that I know that the military works, it would have been someone else's decision. It wouldn't necessarily have been, it would have been. It seems to me that it would be something that Spears would have asked someone to take that position, as opposed to, having Talbert come and say I want to move. But again, there's a lot of poetic license here for obvious reasons, and that's fine. I don't think there's anything wrong with it from that perspective. At this point, the scene changes, and we see Spears and Winters walking through the camp where all these tents are with all the guys, just passing the time, I guess you can say. Winters says, so what else is on your mind? So Spears says, well, I know Easy Company is going to need a commanding officer post-war. Somebody to hold their hand, keep them from killing each other. It better be someone who knows what they're doing. So Winters goes, yep, couldn't agree more. And Spears then says, I mean, it's absolutely irresponsible to leave them in the hands of the wrong person. They're too much of a valuable resource to the military. So Winters looks at him and goes, they decided to stay in the army? He goes, yes, I'm going to stay with the men. Well, I'm glad to hear it. So again, that's it's a great way to show the pseudo passing of the torch completely, between Winters and Spears, even though Spears has been filling that position, for the last few months. But the idea that they're showing the passing of the baton directly, which I think is pretty interesting, because we just talked the other day, when Winters was in the interview. To move to to be able to go to the Pacific right away. And basically he was told, no, you need to stay with your men. And I mean, Winters, obviously he's in a higher position, but he's happy that he knows he's staying with the men, and he's also happy that Spears is going to stay with them to try to have someone look out for them, which is something that Winters says so many times in his memoirs and everything like that, about how he did all he can to help the men of Easy, both the before the war started, obviously during training, during the war, and even afterwards. I like the way that they do that. And then we get a little bit of a narration from Winters. He goes, so some of us would stay by choice, but others were stuck here, lest we could find excuses to send them away. And then the shot changes again. We see Winters with Malarkey, where the two of them are walking, I guess at some sort of dinner or luncheon or something like that. And Winters is in the middle of explaining something. So he says, "So it's an airborne exhibition. They have one of every Allied combat plane they used in the war." I mean, yes, sir. You'll be like a technical advisor and make sure they get everything right. I understand, sir. I'm sorry, it's not more of a hospitable location. And then Malarkey just starts laughing and goes, no, 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 sir. Paris is just fine. And if you need me to go and someone has to be there, Yeah, we do. We absolutely do. Because your driver will drop you off at the hotel of your choice. And I don't think we'll see you back here anytime soon. And then Malarkey turns to him and goes, "I won't let you down, sir." And then he salutes him and he gives him a handshake, which again is something that you don't normally see between an officer and an enlisted man. So again, it's a nice way for them to add on to this, to show the deep and strong connection between the men, between Winters and the men. That again, he needed someone. He wants to help Malarkey, who doesn't necessarily have enough points. So let's move him to Paris, where it's a little easier, in a technical advisory role type of thing. So I like the way that they do that here. To sort of break the distance between them, at the when Malarkey's walking away. And then Lip, who's standing in the back, comes closer to Winters, and he goes, and Winters says to him, "Carward, I want to say, as you probably know, the army, when they give a man a battlefield commission and make him an officer, they usually don't let him stay with the same company." But then says, "Yes, sir. I figured this was coming." "Yeah, they're afraid the men won't show him the proper degree of respect as they would another officer." And Lipson then goes, "Yeah, that's a pretty good theory, sir." And Winters then responds and goes, "It's an idiotic theory, especially in your case. Nevertheless, they've given me the choice as to where to reassign you, and I thought Italian headquarters might be a good place." And Lipton gives a little bit of a smirk as this 5 minute segment ends. So is there anything else that you wanted to discuss, John, about these 5 minutes that we've been talking about?
I think this is kind of a good starting point to something that has been a topic of discussion, like within the history community, and especially like with the work of Stephen E. Ambrose, is, Stephen E. Ambrose, when he wrote his book, was heavily reliant upon the resources that Winters provided him. And then also, it's the accusation has been made that, the book is primarily told through the viewpoint of one Winters, but also Winters' kind of inner circle or circle of favorites, if you will. And I think this scene kind of demonstrates that, because obviously in a company of 100 guys, you're one not going to know every single person that closely. You might know every person by name, but you won't know them intimately, closely, or that, or you're not going to like everybody. And this scene kind of demonstrates that, like, we see Winters starting to pull strings for the people that are established that he likes. Now, in the grand scheme of things, I don't know how much of that really is accurate, but especially, given the modern day view of it, where it's like, yeah, this book is just him and his besties, and now we have a scene like this, it's hard to dissuade those kind of accusations.
Right. Okay. I agree, but I mean, also when you're telling a story like this, it's very difficult to tell a story of 150 men. So
Oh yeah, absolutely.
they have to use the idea of, okay, let's try to show as many of these men that we are already familiar with. And keep them keep them in a good light and show us the strong bond between the men that we're talking about. I mean, it's a known thing that Malarkey was good friends with Winters. That doesn't there's nobody who says that they weren't.
No, yeah. And that's not to diminish or take away from their stories or what happened. It's just what I was trying to get at is that, that's the primary accusation, is that the story of Easy Company oftentimes gets boiled, the claim is that it's boiled down to the story of just a few guys, which absolutely, narratively speaking, you can't tell every single person's story. But that also kind of goes back to the scholarly or the scholar work done by Ambrose, because it's something that's come up in some of his other works where it's he doesn't necessarily run down every avenue. Because I know that that is another complaint, because and this will come up in the next section, I believe, or the section after that we do. But Winters is like, oh yeah, we didn't see this person for however many years, and then he showed up at a reunion and died afterwards. Ambrose, it's not like Ambrose didn't know that there were more than, this half dozen guys that he could have spoken to. Like, because at the time that he wrote Band of Brothers, there's still a good chunk of Easy Company members who are still alive. So I think that's primarily where this accusation comes from.
That's true. But what's again, I've said this many times that the number of men that were in Easy Company, one 10-part, 10-hour miniseries is not even close to being enough to tell everyone's stories. You could have done at least three or four, if not more, 10-part miniseries and focused on other men and still told a slightly different story, the whole way through. So again, because they're somewhat Hollywoodicizing the whole thing, so you need to focus on certain characters. Now, obviously, I'm aware of the fact of everything with Ambrose. After Ambrose died, there was also a lot more accusations of I believe even plagiarism from that. But I've never read any of his other books, so I can't really go into that, and I'm not an expert at all, and I'm also not judgmental on the whole thing. But I mean, like you
It's kind
said,
of like I said at the beginning. I loved reading Ambrose when I was younger.
right. But now that you're older, you can see through the way that his writing tells the
Yeah.
story.
And his
Okay.
works are still an excellent starting point if you want to get into a subject. It's definitely one of those like, okay, he tells the story in a way that captures your attention, and then it's definitely on you to start building out more.
And to
Like
sift through the information and see what's right or not. I mean, again, I've mentioned this many times. The fact that Ambrose wrote the book nearly 50 years after these men went through, everything that they went through. So, not only is can you bring into question possibly, the things that Ambrose wrote, but you can also bring into question the memories of these men. Here you have 70, 80-year-old men that are trying to remember things that they did and said decades earlier, and that's why I can say, with a lot of confidence that there's no way that the book is 100% accurate. What
Oh yeah.
percentage
Well,
of what percentage of accuracy it is, that I couldn't tell you, but it's not
well,
100%.
it's I think a good case in point is I got into an argument with my wife the other day, and we argued a little bit, and then like we both went to our metaphorical corners, if you will, to like cool down or whatever, and then we came back and had a level-headed conversation. But during that level-headed conversation, it's like, well, it upset me when you said this. And it's like, well, I didn't say that. And it's like, this conversation happened 10 minutes ago.
That's right.
Like, so.
Exactly. That's part of the problem by relying on memories for this. And that's also why, Band of Brothers is not a documentary. It's not meant to be 100% accurate. It's meant to tell a story and about heroes of World War II. But parts of it are definitely fictionalized. And you have to all take that with a grain of salt, that not everything that's being told here happened exactly as it's being portrayed. And that goes with any movie or TV show that is based on truth, which is why it always says it's based on a true story, as opposed to it saying this is 100% the true story. You know, because there's always going to be differing opinions. I mean, Ambrose sent out his questionnaire to all the men, and I have no doubt in my mind that he had answers from various men that contradicted one another. And he had to try and figure out, okay, what am I going to put in? You know, am I going to put this in that A said? Am I going to put in what B said? Or am I just going to skip this little part? Because it's, you know, there's no way of knowing. So, you know, but again, that's part of the idea of writing this type of history. I mean, we can even go back to the simplest, you know, mistake that started decades ago and continued because no one ever caught it. You know, the idea that no one knew anything about Blythe. You know, these are there are some blatant things that happened that you know, throughout the course of the miniseries in the book that we now know are not true, but because someone passed on that information, it was perceived as being true. You know, that's just the way the whole thing goes.
Right.
All right, so let's get to today's segment, which is called Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five movie bands. So, John, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
So number five is going to be The Wonders from the Tom Hanks film, That Thing You Do. Number four is going to be the band made up by those kids from the film School of Rock, starring Jack Black. Number three is going to be, this is going to be oddly specific. But have you
That's okay.
seen the film?
I want it to be specific. Of
Have you seen the film Memphis Belle?
course.
So there is a scene early on in the film where they're having a dance in the hangar, and they
Yeah,
have
and
a
Harry Connick Jr. singing.
and they have a big band. So that's my number three, is the just random big band performing at the hangar dance.
Okay.
Number two would be the band that plays at the Back to the Future high school prom.
Marvin Berry and the Starlight.
Yeah, the cousin to Chuck Berry.
Yes.
And then my number one would be Spinal Tap.
All right, that is a great list. Thank you very much for that. All right, and now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie. I'm
I
going
feel like
to.
I'm going to disappoint people if I get this wrong, considering I host a war movie podcast.
Well, you know, it's, some of them are a little obscure, so you know, you get a little bit of a pass if you miss them. But let's see. Let's spin the wheel and randomly see what you're going to get. Okay, this is a movie from 1962, and it's about an American unit that battles the Japanese forces in Burma. And the movie was directed by Sam Fuller, and it stars Jeff Chandler, Ty Harden. Have any idea what movie this might be?
I've only seen one film about Burma, or I only remember one film about Burma, so I'm going to give this as my answer, which is Objective Burma.
No, sorry, that was 1945. But this one's Merrill's Marauders. Have you seen it or have you heard
I saw it a long, long time ago.
Okay, I've actually never seen it. It's something that's on my list that I plan to eventually get to. But I've heard it's quite good. So I'm definitely looking forward to eventually seeing it. All right, excellent. So, John, would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
Yeah, thanks. Like we said earlier, I'm one of the hosts of the Armchair Commanders podcast. I do it with a good buddy of mine, and we oftentimes have guests of different varieties. Like I said, we've had actors from Band of Brothers, we've had historians that have written books, we've had other podcasters, other people within the history community, like museum curators and stuff like that. So if you're interested in another podcast that looks at movies, specifically war movies, come check us out. We're on all the major streaming platforms, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Audible, all those good places. And for social media, we're on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok under Armchair Commanders Podcast.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Route Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, movieroutminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieroutminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, Curry!
Curry.